Romans referred to the sweltering heat of July and August as the Dog Days, so named for Canis Major, a constellation whose brightest star, Sirius, appears near the sun in this period. It was the presence of both stars together, the Romans believed, that created the heat. Each year, the Dog Days run from 3 July to 11 August and have become synonymous with the height of summer. It's no surprise, then, that Sidney Lumet chose to call his beloved 1975 film starring Al Pacino and John Cazale Dog Day Afternoon. What I didn't know is that this wild affair was actually based on a true story. In 2022, Daniel Edward Rosen penned a terrific article on the subject, aptly titled The Deacon and the Dog. Set to the backdrop of a gritty, noir, Brian De Palma era New York, petty crooks, crimes of passion, showmanship, and tragedy ensue in a heart-wrenching, truly bizarre story that affirms something we already know. Truth really is stranger than fiction. Before beginning in earnest, I'd like to thank the Manhattan Institute and plug their City Journal, a quarterly magazine whose contributors like Heather McDonald and Dan have made for some great episodes. Thank you very much and happy listening. Daniel Edward Rosen, thanks so much for coming on to 27 Rouge.
Tyler, my pleasure. Thank you, Scott, for having me.
So I'd like to set the scene here, the scene not being the present day, but the 1970s in New York. Mm-hmm. Plenty of robberies going on, plenty of crime going on, plenty of, Chinatown shit, like noir, sepia, gray, unsavory stuff happening. What was the 70s like in New York then?
Well, you certainly got the cinematography right. And you certainly got the 70s in New York were a very brutal, somewhat violent time. And, in the early 70s in particular, especially as it relates to federal crime, you had bank robberies happening at essentially at a daily clip. I think something like 470 plus, between 71 and 72. If I'm not mistaken. And there were airplane hijackings somewhat frequently. And, a lot of the crimes that were committed, they were not necessarily, They weren't necessarily well thought out in many instances.
Yeah.
A lot of people just felt, well, I'll just go and rob a bank, or I'll go and I'll hijack a plane. I'll make a ton of money and I'll get away scot-free. And almost always it never happened. Mm. And you also have to look at just the nature of the violent crimes. Murders were high, shootings were high. And, we're at this very particular moment in New York City history where we're not seeing exactly the same numbers, but we're certainly seeing the nature of the crimes, certainly escalate, which is of big concern. But, New York back then was very dangerous and very unique.
Yeah. I'm a little confused by that because what's causing this? Like the unhappy 60s children who went around drinking, smoking, fucking, and forgetting their way through the 60s, wake up in the 70s, 10 years later after taking, one too many pills, and they're like, fuck, I took too many drugs. My life sucks. Now I'm going to take out my anger by robbing banks or, there was a financial crisis at some point in the 70s, I think.
Later in the 70s. So.
And I wasn't around for this. This was a year or two before my golden years. But what was causing this environment of crime? Was it an antipathy towards the law or a rebellion against authority? Or New York, is a nice enough city. What were people so upset about that they needed to be robbing banks all the time?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think, as it relates to the John Woodowich robbery, which I wrote about, a lot of others, most of it is just crimes of passion. Mm. I think part of it was there was a very strong anti-law enforcement sentiment at the time, especially in the early 70s when you had the Attica prison riots, which you had a large number of prisoners, both prisoners and guards, essentially getting shot up by authorities. Mm. Part of it is just, it was wild. And, in the case of Woodowich, which we'll eventually get into, and two other bank robberies, or rather two other instances that happened within that year, which were hijackings. One being a guy named Richard Obergefell, and then the other being Heinrich von George, who basically two men who were, you know, very desperate men. They decide to rob, you know, hijack a plane again with this harebrained idea that they can get six figures in ransom, and then just, you know, get away scot-free. And both of them ended up dying. They were killed at the hands of FBI agents. So I think that a lot of these crimes, I'm sure there were socioeconomic reasons, but, you know, those three in particular were really just because of the circumstances that led them to these crimes are essentially just bad luck and bad decisions and dumb decisions. So, yeah. And I think that, you know, very short-sighted, very, very short-sighted criminal strategies, crime strategies. So I think that's another culprit.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned like crimes of passion, which I think, you know, for all of this, you can't help but have something of a sympathy for these people. You know, not a sympathy, but, it's maybe it's not so much a rebellion against authority as coming from a place of desperation. You know, obviously bad choices are made, but people feel as if they don't have any other options. And then that's why, you know, these are not, you know, extremely well thought out, well planned out, you know, Ocean's 11 affairs. They're very much sort of off the cuff, figure it out as you go. And then a lot of times, you know, met with disastrous consequences. But let's get into what actually happened here. Why don't you give us the cliff notes? Dog Day Afternoon, it's the movie. Yeah. A lot of people have seen that. What a lot of people might not know or might have forgotten is that, you know, it's actually based off of some real life shit. So tell us what happened.
Yeah. You know, and to your point, you know, some people think this was a political stand, or, you know, kind of this grand, in the case of Woodridge, just sort of this grand anti-authority demonstration, when really it was just, you know, in this case, a guy was trying to win back his lover in the most inane way possible, certainly dangerous way possible. So the story of, you know, the real story of Dog Day Afternoon, which is, you know, one of the all time great movies. There's a guy named John Woodridge. John Woodridge was a Vietnam vet, and at the time a married father of two, who, when he returned from Vietnam, you know, he eventually, you know, over time, he had kind of strayed from his family, become involved with gay activism, and also had become basically started sleeping around. He was fairly promiscuous, and he was at a street festival. And he had met a gentleman by the name of Ernest Aaron, and Ernest Aaron was a at the time, and there's a great movie on John Woodridge. Great documentary on Woodridge called The Dog. It sort of intimated in the dog that Ernest was a bit of a hustler on the side. He was dressed in semi-drag, and, you know, at the time had wanted to transition to becoming a woman. You know, John.
This is the 70s.
This is the early 70s. Yeah. John, you know, eventually, you know, he courted him. They, you know, they kind of had this tempestuous love affair. John was against the idea of him transitioning into a woman, and so that was cause of strife. And after many arguments, Ernest tried to commit suicide by overdosing on pills. And he was committed to a hospital. And then John, in sort of his very romantic way, decided that he would rob a bank to get, and the money that he had stolen, he would use it to pay for Ernest's sex change operation. Then that's what brings them to that fateful day in August, to a Chase Manhattan bank branch, in Gravesend, Brooklyn. what followed. Hilarity, history, and unfortunately a tragedy ensued on that day. So,
you know. Hilarity, history, and tragedy. Yeah. What kind of pills did Ernest take to try to overdose?
It was like antidepressants and some sleeping pills. A few others. I think she had gotten them from friends. Ernest had transitioned into, not to cut to the chase, she did transition to Elizabeth Eden, and the money that that John had gotten from the selling his film rights helped pay for that.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. And wow. I mean, you talk about truth being stranger than fiction. I thought the movie was a movie, you know, I didn't know it was based on a true story. So one thing that interests me here is sort of the oddities, like, of what goes down and like split second decisions, like not even oddities, but just how history is made in a lot of times by like the decisions of individual people. Mm-hmm. So what do we make of this decision to not shoot? Why didn't he shoot?
For Jim Murphy.
To maybe tell people who Jim Murphy is.
Absolutely. So, so what happens, and the movie was very faithful to at least to how the robbery unfolded. John had enlisted a young man named Sal Naturale, who was, he was sort of a small time crook, and sort of like a wayward youth. In fact, I think he had been kicked out of his hometown in New Jersey by the by the authorities because he did do time.
Expelled.
Yes, he was kicked out because he did do time for robbery, or at least petty theft. And so he, Sal, and another man named Bobby Westenberg, who at the very end chickened out and didn't go inside with him to the bank. They held about eight tellers, eight people or nine people, including a security guard, held them hostage. They realized that they were robbing the bank after the money had been picked up. So there was far less money than they had anticipated. It was about 3 o'clock towards the tail end of the day. And they had simply taken too long. John had, they stole traveler's checks worth an absurd amount of money, a decent amount of cash. But while the robbery was unfolding, the bank manager, he received a telephone call from the Chase Manhattan corporate office in New York about a personnel change, and through coded language had basically tipped off the Chase Manhattan Bank that there was a robbery in progress. Mm. And so then the police descend, and then through that a crowd descends. And so they're cornered, but then because of the hullabaloo, if you will, it drew this huge crowd of people from the neighborhood. And then there was just this, as you've seen in the movie with that, as it was in the case of the movie, as it was in real life, there was a standoff between John and at first the NYPD and Sal Naturale. I should say both of these men were armed with, a rifle and a shotgun and a pistol. Sal stayed in the bank holding all the people hostage while John went out and effectively, talked to authorities and was somewhat of a bit of kind of a showman as well, because they're playing to the crowd. But, to your point, I did an interview for this for New York One, and, they asked interesting questions. Why didn't they just, essentially arrest John right there? Why didn't they just shoot him? And I think what's so remarkable, or at least he didn't really say it such a explicit way, but the police couldn't do anything, and they had to show restraint because, again, Sal was in the bank holding eight people hostage, a large number of people hostage, at gunpoint, and he was a large unknown, while John essentially was just acting as a last minute hostage last minute showman.
Yeah.
But you know, through the negotiations and through a lot of the media interviews, because people were the press were able to call into the bank and speak to John and ask him, like, why are you doing this? And he just said, yeah, I'm here to do this with to free my wife, Ernest Aaron. He's a man. I'm gay. I'm doing this to pay for his sex change operation. And so then they bring Ernest from the hospital to the scene. Eventually, Ernest refuses to meet with John because he's terrified. But really, within the span of hours, all these kind of just amazing details of the story itself come out.
And brought to life to the world.
Yeah. And it was – and this predates social media and it predates – the modern news, the modern news mechanism that we have today. And you just look at the news, you read the stories, you look at the news features. And it was just amazing how all of this, how all the salacious details of the case unfolded and come out in the press. Like, they found photos of both John and Ernest's wedding. They had kind of a wedding, although it wasn't like an official wedding, but, Ernest was dressed in drag, Ernest's, bridesmaids were men. They're dressed in bridesmaids outfits. And it's all that really within hours is broadcast on the news. And so, yeah. And I think John certainly played it, he certainly played to the crowd. And, to your point earlier about, the nature of the crimes back then was just like, were these people making political stands? Not in John's case. Some people would think like that he's kind of being a Robin Hood, stealing from the rich to give to the poor, but he really was just someone who was way in over his head.
Yeah.
For Jim Murphy, who was the FBI agent I'd interviewed for this.
What did Jim say about this whole situation, that he felt bad he couldn't shoot the guy because, he pitied him? Or Jim's relationship with what was Jim thinking? Or tell me about Jim. He sounds like an interesting guy, one of these like hardened, smart, but still like kind of nice dudes. I wouldn't say nice as in like overly nice, but he seems like a good man, like never miss a day of work, Irish guy, who works hard but likes his whiskey. And I don't know anything about him. What's Jim like?
Jim, I don't know if he likes his whiskey, but Jim is, Jim, I say just from personal experience, is a very good man. I think Jim, the way this came about is, I'm working on the book about the FBI in the 70s and 80s. And Jim was this, kind of revered figure within the Bureau because of Dog Day Afternoon, and also in part of just, later when he became an ASAC, which is Assistant Secretary at Charge of the Brooklyn Queens Metropolitan Resident Agency. He was someone who is, I kind of want to say like a monastic figure, but he's someone who, he's not braggadocious. He doesn't necessarily like, I was struck by just how solemn and certainly in no ways, just sort of, there's no pride in what had happened for the audience, eventually, Sal Naturale is shot and killed by Jim Murphy when they freed the hostages, which we'll get into it. But I think in the case of Jim, Jim's a very, kind of a seasoned law enforcement guy who, he came from the NYPD prior to joining the FBI. He worked for the bank robbery squad, which in the early 1970s for the FBI was the premier. That was essentially the squad that every FBI agent who moved to New York wanted to be in, because the frequency of the crimes and the nature of the crimes themselves, bank robberies, hijackings, hostage negotiations, SWAT, and just also the agents who worked there too, guys named Tom Shearer, who would eventually become a director of the New York headquarters in the 80s. And you had Kenny Love and Jack Jansen and Steve Carbone. And Steve Carbone would be a legend in his own right within the FBI when he, with his mob investigations of Lufthansa and a few others, Lufthansa heist. These were agents who they were not afraid of confrontation. And they were not afraid to volunteer themselves in situations like the Woodwich robbery. And because essentially, you don't like, you know, some people get into the FBI, you know, to raise the ranks. Maybe they've sort of, I don't want to say political aspirations, but certainly, you know, administrative aspirations to eventually become director, this and that. But these guys in New York, they wanted to work these kinds of cases, and they wanted to be in New York at a time when not
Why?
Many agents.
Why? It's not a, this is like the Untouchables.
It's like the Untouchables, but it's also like the qual. It sounds a bit, I don't know.
The wannabe heroes. These are guys who came back from Vietnam and they were not done fighting. Like what are we talking about here?
Not in the slightest. It sounds a bit oxymoronic, but like, you know, it's sort of like the nature of the crimes themselves and the fact that it is New York City. And you know, when you have some agents who grew up, you know, they grew up outside of New York City.
They're hero. It's a heroic thing.
It's heroic, but it's also just, it's the crime. It's really just the action. I'll leave it at that because people who move to New York, agents, especially back then, they don't want to move here because they have to relocate their families. It's extremely expensive. They're working at the time. The New York City headquarters were on 69th Street. And so it was a real pain in the ass to cover the entirety of New York City, all five boroughs from the Upper East Side. You and I are native Upper East Siders and we know how not necessarily accessible it can be. But at the end of the day, like you had agents who wanted to be there because of the fact that you can work bank robberies at such a frequency. You can confront people who are dangerous, people who are dangerous criminals. You also had, you know, political activists. You had, you know, all sorts of things where there was bombings. There were, it really was at a time when the crime itself, it either scared you off as an agent, or it was the challenge you wanted to step up to. Because frankly, let's face it, New York has, if there's one place that has all the great crime, especially in the federal sense, that there's corruption, there's crime, there's what have you, New York City had it. Maybe Chicago too, but New York City was its own particular, I hate saying as a crime market, but it certainly was a territory that appealed to agents like Jim, like Tom Scheer, like Ken Lovin, who I interviewed for this piece. Because you don't go into the bureau to make a lot of money. You don't go into the bureau to essentially, for a lot of people, to become a bureaucrat. You go into the bureau essentially to work cases. Mm. That pretty much was the nature of Jim and a lot of the other people. And that's what I was struck by with Jim. I mean, Jim had worked, you know, he was an NYPD cop for a number of years. He joined the bureau. He was the son of, he grew up in Queens. The Queens-Nassau border. He had you know, his father owned a bunch of neighborhood-owned restaurants, I believe. But he was someone who essentially wanted to work this because he understood the nature of the crime and he could actually investigate and handle New York City cases.
Yeah. Dan, I just want to make sure we're okay logistically. Your iPhone's still recording here, right?
Yeah.
Good. Just double checking. So on the subject of Jim, yeah, no, it's interesting. Like, I mean, some people are in it for the action. People are in it because it's a good job. It's an interesting job. You're giving back. It's a foreign world to me. I read about it. I've seen TV shows about it. Yeah. But of course, I've never interacted with an FBI agent yet. I actually think I have one coming on the show, and at some point in the next coming weeks, I have to get that scheduled. Or a former one. I don't know if he's former or current. I think he's. I have to double check that. But anyway, no, it's one of those things that has been so dramatized on television and books and movies that I think a lot of us think we know what FBI agents are like, but mm-hmm. none of us have a fucking clue. In the same way that, you know, none of us who haven't, you know, played a professional sport think we know what football is like. So people, you know, I want to talk here a little bit about the film versus real life. What were some of the differences, or what did you think about it personally? What was your personal opinion?
Well, I mean, I love the movie. I mean, obviously the movie is, you know, is an all-time classic. And you know, the difference in the film, for one, you know, you look at the betrayal, you know, Jim is portrayed by Lance Henriksen, who's, you know, the famous character actor, kind of a very grim-faced man. And the FBI agents, Dick Baker's, I forget the actor who played Dick Baker. Dick Baker was one of the heads of the New York City office who handled negotiations with Wojtowicz towards the tail end of the standoff. You know, they're kind of portrayed as kind of cold, somewhat calculating people. But again, if you look at the negotiations, especially on the newscast, it seems like people are just, you know, the way they treat it is just like another day, you know, in Brooklyn. It's just like, all right, what do you want to do? What are we going to do here? You want to get out? Are you guys going to fly? How are you going to get out of here? And so I think, you know, I don't think it was, you know, obviously they're going to portray the FBI, you know, as kind of these very, I don't want to say menacing, but they're certainly, you watch it and they're, you know, there's something about them that seems a bit, I don't know, calculating to a certain degree. I think, you know, but really what happened there was, you know, the FBI, their position and their strategy was to keep them in the bank as long as possible and to make it uncomfortable for them. And by that, I mean, you know, eventually they cut off the air conditioning inside the bank. You know, they were hung, you know, the hostages were, they cut off also, they cut off the telephone lines because John, you know, that was John's, you know, John's connection to the outside world. And he was certainly, you know, speaking to whoever would call into the bank, whichever news organization. You know, their whole strategy was first to draw it out, to eventually get them to release hostages. But they knew that these guys didn't necessarily have an escape plan because they never anticipated, you know, they all thought they were going to get out in time scot-free. And so, you know, when eventually they decide, John and Sal decide to request an airplane to fly to, you know, destinations unknown outside the country. You know, the FBI eventually worked to get to secure a plane. They then had to negotiate how they were going to get the hostages and both John and Sal to JFK. And so, you know, because then that would put Jim and some of the other agents in the cars with them as drivers and right. would give them an opportunity to essentially take over, you know, the handle of the situation. Eventually, after negotiations, they decided to do an airplane limousine. An airplane limousine back in the day, it kind of looks like, I don't know if you've seen Ghostbusters. I don't know if you remember that hearse they had.
Yeah.
You know, they drove. An airplane limousine looks it's not too different from that. Sort of like an inelegant kind of bulky car. And so when they agree that they would have an FBI drive them to the airport with the hostages in the airplane limousine, and they would drop off and they would first release the hostages when they all left the bank, and then they release another hostage at the airport. They then presented John with four agents who knew the way to JFK from Gravesend. And these were all four agents who had worked within the bank robbery squad. One of them was Tom Scheer. One of them was Jack Jansen, who was a near 300-pound man who a short while before had actually rescued a stewardess and killed a skyjacker.
Skyjacker.
Yeah. I'm going to give him a shout out because he's a great guy. Brendan Corner wrote a great book about skyjacking, and my 43-year-old brain is not working, but I think it's The Skies Belong to Us. I don't know if this is going to be on video, but here, The Skies Belong to Us. This is on video.
The Skies Brendan Belong Corner's to book. Us.
Sky Belongs to Us by Brendan Corner. Excellent book. You know, and so John's looking at this, you know, Jack Jansen, 300 pounds. Tom Scheer is a former Marine who played guard for University of Florida. You know, these are big guys. And they had, I forget the third agent, but he's sort of a tall, like this guy was almost like 6'7", 6'8". And then there's Jim, who's, you know, Jim's of average height. He seems like a normal guy. looks like, you know, looks like you're a regular fella. And he pointed at Jim. He's like, I'll take him. And so Jim, they then decided, okay, so how we're going to get Jim in the car and how we're going to secrete a gun. Because eventually the plan was they drive into the airport, and once at the airport, again, they would draw things out. They make them wait. And they would devise a plan to overtake both Sal and John. And so eventually they decide to put the gun underneath the floorboard, the floor mat, excuse me,
of the car. The agents, the two of them, Jim and, yep. and the, yeah.
Well, yeah, just Jim. Because in the movie, what they do is they put the gun inside the, on the driver's inside the little armrest of the driver's side door. But in this case, what they did was they put it underneath the floor mat. And so when Jim drove to the front of the car, to the bank, excuse me, John came out. He had to search him. And John made a great show of it, too. You know, going back to my earlier point about him kind of playing to the crowd, like, he kind of went slowly up Jim's crotch and went slowly down. Kind of looked like he was molesting him, and the crowd's obviously going crazy. And, Jim's red faced about it. And, sort of felt humiliated. But the gun, yeah. But then he told Jim to go back into the car. No, seriously. He put Jim back into the car, and Jim immediately put his foot on the brake, which was directly above where the gun was. And so, John searched the car, never thinking to go underneath the floorboard or underneath his foot. And so the gun essentially was secure. When John and Sal eventually all make their way into the airplane limousine, the way it's seated is Sal's about one row away behind Jim. He has a shotgun directly towards the back of his head. All the other hostages are seated behind him. And these are like three people to a seat, to a row. And so, they're driving out to JFK, Jim's being his chai. So like, hey, you wind up lifting up the gun away from my head. I don't want my wife getting mad at me for getting shot. Kind of just easing them up with small talk. And when they drove out, they get up to JFK and they go to a area, which is right by a blast fence, which is a place that the FBI regularly uses or diverts hostage negotiations or air hijackings to, because it's, for one, the blast fences are, blast fences are pretty tall. They're able to position snipers behind them. And also it doesn't interfere with JFK air traffic.
Yeah.
And so, when they get to the, eventually they get to the blast fence, they get into that area, excuse me. There's Dick Baker, who's in the car in front of them. They're on the tarmac. Dick comes out. They're sort of just talking again, same small talk. They ask, the John and all the hostages were really hungry because they hadn't eaten all day. They wanted hamburgers. They had delivered pizzas. They delivered pizzas to the bank, but the hostages wouldn't eat it. Well, at least they were afraid they wouldn't eat it. They were afraid of the pizza because they thought the pizza had been drugged. And so, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And so then, to go back to the showman, and this was actually, they did happen. The movie has this too. When John paid for the pizza, he threw the cash up in the air and it kind of caused a mad scramble for, sending FBI agents and cops and even some bystanders to grab the money. So knowing that these guys were hungry, Jim said that he was going to go out and talk to Dick Baker. He was allowed to leave the car. And I should add that after John, to step back a bit, after John had searched the car and didn't find the gun, Jim took the gun from out underneath the floorboard and put it in his belt and covered the gun handle with his tie. And so he's talking to Dick in the middle of the tarmac away from the car. And they agree that when the plane is coming out, when the plane turns into where they are, Jim would ask him is there food for these people on the plane? And that would basically signal to Dick that he could overtake, Sal's shotgun. And if Dick had said yes, that meant that Dick can basically overtake John, because John at the time was sitting in the back row. He had this gun on his lap. And Sal was essentially, here's Jim, the gun about inches away from his head. And Jim could easily just overtake the gun and shoot him. And so with that in mind, they go back into the car. Jim sits back in the driver's seat. And after a short while, the plane arrives and it's turning. And, the sound of the engines and, the glare of the lights. And Sal's really nervous. And Dick's standing by the window right by where John's mm-hmm. sitting. That window's open. And Jim, Jim's like this. He's got his shoulder. He's got his gun in his right hand that's hidden. And Jim also said that had Sal looked at the driver's side mirror, at the rear view mirror, he could have seen that Jim was holding a gun. But they never caught on to that. But, with both of them in position, Jim asks if there's food on the people for this plane. Is there food on these people for the plane? Dick says yes. So Dick rips the gun off of John's lap. Jim pushes the gun up into the roof of the limousine. Sal reaches up with both hands to try and pull it down. And Jim shoots him in the midsection. He goes down. And meanwhile, all the hostages are streaming out. And he basically tells John
streaming out of where?
Getting out of the car. They're streaming out. So all the doors open. All the hostages are running out of the limousine. And then
on this tarmac area in this blast
area. Now there are cops everywhere. So they also had SWAT members outside. And so John, I imagine is a bit stunned. Jim sees his hands going down, and they knew that he had a pistol in his belt. And he told him, put your fucking hands up right now. And to your point, why he didn't shoot. He could have easily just shot him, but he didn't have any court. I mean, at the moment, he could have been justified. But to his point, he said, he didn't necessarily, it would have been, people would have seen it as a justified act, but he didn't think that was the way to act. After telling him to keep his hands up, eventually John surrendered. And, because of Jim, I think one thing's, yes, Sal had passed, Sal had died, but, he did save a lot of hostages. He did put an end to a bank robbery that, was essentially a bit of a whirlwind and certainly a bit of a carnival and certainly not like a masterfully executed robbery. And I think that for him, living with the aftermath and to your earlier question about, who Jim, like what Jim's like, Jim's a very religious man. He's a Catholic. Mm-hmm. He had said that he feels there's sorrow, but he doesn't feel guilt. And there's two distinctions there, because when you think of guilt, that means that's an admission of wrongdoing, which in his case, he doesn't believe was a case of wrongdoing because, again, he had saved a number of people. People were being held hostage. And this, as much as you fall in love with, John Cazale and Al Pacino in the movie itself, at the end of the day, people were in danger. Granted, they were all like getting along famously, but once they get on the plane, what happens? Who knows where are they going to go? And besides, there were FBI agents positioned on that plane. So, essentially there was no way out. So no matter what, this was always going to be the ending. And so I think for Jim, he feels sorrow for Sal. He wishes Sal, it could have been different. He wishes these guys had decided before they robbed the bank, this is not a good idea. We'll leave. But it happened. They put Jim in that position. And when you're an FBI agent, you're responsible for dealing with federal crimes like bank robberies and hijackings. Essentially, that's what the job calls for. So,
So there was only ever one way for this to end.
Pretty much, because they're not going to name me a bank other than who's the guy? It was a DB. I forget the guy's name. The famous, it was a DB Cooper. The guy who robbed a bank, who basically hijacked a plane, got a bunch of money, and you know, jumped out of the plane mid-flight.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to say D.B. Sweeney, but that's the great actor from the 90s. But no, but he, you know, that's really, you look at the other, these other banks, they never, these other instances, they don't end with success. It all ends in someone getting killed or someone getting arrested. And so there's just, there was no way this whole thing could have succeeded. And I think people think, it's easy to say, well, why didn't Jim say freeze? Why didn't they let them go on the plane and let them land somewhere and take them there? These guys were freelancing. These guys, I mean, John and Sal, and they were freelancing with, at some point, 8 to 9 people's lives in their hands. And you can't take that chance. You know, as charming as they were, you don't know what, John's out of his mind. This guy doesn't know what he's doing. He's just, It sucked that someone had to die, but unfortunately, I would like to say that their hands were forced, they being the FBI.
Yeah. So what is your new, what is this new book about? Is it a secret, or do you want to?
No, I mean, right now working.
Talk a little bit about.
I'll happily talk about. So it's about, it goes back to my earlier point about agents who worked in New York City and understood the crimes. And so Jim was of this generation of guys who grew up in New York City, who wanted to be FBI agents, didn't necessarily look the part. These were guys who, these guys who grew up in Queens and Brooklyn or just out in Nassau County. And they're not exactly like, the people you think of when you think of the traditional like Hoover era G-man. But they wanted to work in New York headquarters at a time when no one wanted to work there within the Bureau because of just the cost of living and how prohibitively expensive it was for them to raise a family and work there. And so, in this case, it looks at the BQMRA, which is a Metropolitan Resident Agency, which was the first of its kind for the Bureau, because they realized that in part – it would be good for morale to have guys based in Brooklyn and Queens rather than having them cover that territory from the Upper East Side. Suddenly it was easier for agents to get to work and it was easier for them to work cases in the Eastern District. But really within moments of it opening, the Lufthansa heist happens, which, it's the basis of which happens in Goodfellas. Then you have Henry Hill, then you have Wingfoot, and you have all these cases, and then you have the pizza connection. All these cases that suddenly within moments just unfold. And, and then all of a sudden the New York headquarters, it's like, well, we opened this for you to make it more convenient, not for you to basically, make us look, you kind of just beat us, get points on the board, more points on the board than us. And so you have this very interesting dynamic of all these New York born and bred agents who wanted to work who kind of had their own little, their own little office, their own little territory. And you had these mafia, mob crimes and hijacking crimes, and all these other kind of, the speed to which these crimes are unfolding. It's incredible. And you talk to the agents who work there, this is why we became agents. We didn't want to go and become Mueller. They wanted to actually work these kinds of crimes. And so it really looks at the book is basically about, seeing through these agents' eyes. So, Jim's there, Steve Carbone, Margot Dennedy, Neil Moran, Warren Flagg, who's in the recent documentary about Tim Donaghy. And George Hanna, all these these revered FBI figures really worked out of there. Aguevara, Lou Schillero. And it's really just, it's sort of like a murderer's row, in a terrible way to put it, but it really is sort of like this, the talent that came out of there, the odds that they were faced with and the nature in which they handled these cases, really is, it really was remarkable. So, essentially it's telling from their perspective. Because, especially now at a time where the FBI is not necessarily popular, and it's become its own it's become a lot of the work they've done has been politicized for better, rightly or wrongly. you know, it's sort of a very unique period of, you know, it's the 70s and the 80s. The 70s and 80s that we see in the films. It's, you know, it's, to your point, you know, it's the sepia toned, you know, beautiful, you know, the gray.
The forget it Jake era. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. The, you know, the Brian, it's like the Brian, it's the Brian De Palma, you know, the gritty Brian De Palma, Scorsese, Lumet, era films, era, New York.
So. Well, let me just, I want to wrap up here by just asking a question about conclusions. To conclude, I'd like to ask a question about conclusions.
Absolutely.
As the poet, as the poet that I am. So, you know, the 1970s was a fucking shit show in New York. It was real rough. It was, we could coin it a forget it Jake era. It sounds like, you know this better than I did. And yet, you know, we kept taking trips around the sun and, you know, things moved forward and New York did not fall and it's still one of the greatest cities in the world. And, you know, New York persisted, one might say. So now there's a question of what's happening with New York right now. A lot of people think that the city is under siege and that, you know, there's crime happening left and right. There was that horrible subway shooter incident. And so, you know, how did they sort of get out of this in one piece in the 1970s, and how are they going to get out of this in one piece today? I know you can't really answer the second one, but maybe you could answer the first one.
I think if you look at New York City, it always, you know, part of it is, you know, a change in approach by, you know, the mayoral administration, you know, especially with Koch and later with Giuliani in the late 80s and 90s. They changed the way things were policed. They adopt new crime strategies like broken windows, which is something that I think they should bring back. But unfortunately, you know, but no, I let me rephrase. They should bring back to a certain degree, but, you know, the unfortunate part is, you know, a lot of, you know, drugs are petty crimes like public urination and weed, what have you. Weed, rightly so, should not be as heavily prosecuted as it was. But, you know, there was, you know, when you look at the smaller crimes that affect quality of life, you know, it does have a it certainly has, a good effect in curtailing a crime. But, you know, to your point about how do they get out of it and like how do they survive, you know, especially in the 70s when you had
not survive, but how did the city itself?
Well, that's what I'm saying. The city survives. It really is part of it. I had to say, you know, it's the resilience of the people who live here. And it's the resilience of the fact that the city always goes through these tragedies. And there is, you know, it's immediately followed by, well, that's the end. City's done. But, you know, it eventually, you know, I experienced that, you know, when I graduated college, 9/11 happened. I was here for it. I saw it. And then, you know, the sentiment afterwards was like, well, that's it. The city's now, you know, a terrorist hotspot. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be destroyed by a nuclear bomb. But like it never happened. And everyone adapted and grew and the city flourished. And I think we're seeing that now with COVID. You know, after COVID, people thought, well, that's that. Crime's on the way up. You know, the streets are being overtaken by, you know, by vagrants, you know, by homeless kids, and you know, subways are dangerous now to ride because, you know, people are shooting up people at random. But, you know, I've lived here. I take the subway to work pretty much every day. Like I don't see it. I, you know, knock on wood, I've yet to see something that would say, all right, well, this is the end of the city. It's just complete bedlam. No, yeah. I think that, I mean, granted, it would be good to see a police presence because in the end of the day, just the seeing police on trains is enough to, you know, stop people or just having some type of, you know, visible, presence. But it is scary because people are getting, you know, it's people are getting killed over stupid, petty arguments. And, you know, I think that happened this past weekend. There were like three people who were killed, you know, over stabbings, and all in subways alone. There's one a guy who worked who worked at Citi Field, who was killed after an argument and on the subway. And so, like, I think that now, if they could get out of the 70s the way they had done, we can most certainly get out of this now. But you know, the fact that the concealed carry is now that anyone can have a gun, it's a little, it'll be interesting to see how things unfold, but, that's just my opinion, but I think that the city is more resilient than you would think and is able to go through these things, you know, because people are like, oh, the city's dying, I'm moving to Florida. Then most, you know, I'm sure about 70% of the people who move to Florida do miss the city and do, you know, do wish to be back because, you know, New York is its own beast and it's unmatched.
It is. It's one of a kind. I think that you raised two interesting points here. First being that, you know, every time there's some great tragedy, people immediately go to the extreme and they throw their hands up in the air and they go, oh, well, you know, that's the end of it. And yet it never is, at least in the instances that you've mentioned. I think that speaks to the character of New York. First of all, I think there's a lesson here about persistence and about not giving up on something or someone that you love. And that, you know, that really has a lot to offer. And I also think that, you know, some of this is trumped up by these things are happening. You know, there was that guy in Brooklyn, who put on a gas mask and shot up the subway car like a fucking horror movie. That being said, I was in New York right after that. I was in New York in April and I rode the subway every day without issue. I never saw any fights or stabbings. You know, I saw some other weirdness on the subway, but, you know, I took the subway every day. I left New York a long time ago. Coming back, a lot of things had changed, but, you know, I still took the subways and still walked down the same streets and, the lights still shined brightly. So, it's a wonderful city. I think a lot of times we were too quick to write things off, in our personal lives, in our professional lives, in our relationships with each other. It's just, maybe just writing things off immediately is not only that it's not an efficient thing to do, but it's just not the right thing to do. Anyway, that you know, popped into my mind. I want to defend New York. I know there's a lot of haters out there.
Yeah.
That being said, I'm defending from a distance. I left, not to Florida, but I left.
No, but you're, you know, for the record, you know, for your listeners, you're both anyway, Scott in New York. Yeah. Sorry, I was just saying for the record, you know, both Scott and I grew up in New York City, you know, both, you know, Upper East Side natives. And, you know, I think, you know, I grew up in the 80s and 90s here and certainly saw and lived here, you know, babies lived here since 80. I moved here in 82 from London when I was a kid. And I think, you know, the city is always going to go through these ebbs and flows. And crime is always going to be a constant. It's just, you know, to what degree is it a problem, and to what degree is it not? But it affects the city, but it certainly doesn't turn the city into like a Mad Max wasteland. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, Daniel Edward Rosen, thanks so much for coming on to the show.
Great to talk to you, man. I appreciate you having me.